Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, where we dive into life lessons from athletes, entrepreneurs, experts, leaders, writers, and difference makers. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and they've learned a few things along the way. In What I Wish I Knew, they share those lessons with you. This is our 35th episode, and if there's one thing we've learned from the guests on What I Wish I Knew, it's this. No matter the obstacles, these people always find a way. Please subscribe, follow, and rate us on your favorite podcast platform, and join our email list at whatiwishiknewshow.com. Good health has never been more important, nor as top of mind as it has been this past year. And we've heard from so many that they wish they'd taken care of their health before they lost it. That's why we're excited to have Dr. Richard Harris on the show today. Dr. Harris is a physician, pharmacist, and expert in holistic lifestyle medicine. His mission? To help people live better quality lives and recognize how the choices they make contribute to their health. Today, we're talking about the obstacles most of us face in trying to live healthy, how the mental side affects the physical. We'll also get into health span versus lifespan. It's an important distinction that you'll want to know about. And we'll talk about the four simple steps that we can all take to improve our health. Along with his medical practice, Dr. Harris is founder of Great Health and Wellness, Harris Medical Consultants, managing director of the New Spectrum Educational Consultants, and co-founder of the 40 Acres Fund. He's also host of the Strive for Great Health podcast. Dr. Richard Harris, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that fantastic intro.
So put us in context. What's your story?
Yeah, it's really interesting because my story was completely crafted by God, because there's no way that I could have done everything that I did, because a lot of the things that I ended up have been providence. To me, it was a complete accident, but it's providence. I started off very interested in books about whales and dolphins and sharks and anatomy. I was 5 or 6 years old reading that stuff. My parents thought I was super weird because they're like, why aren't you reading the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and Goosebumps like the rest of your classmates? And I had read every book on dinosaurs, every book on sharks, and every book on snakes from the local library. So they had to start buying books from other places to get me information that I wanted. And so I'd always been interested in science, and I'd always been interested in helping people. There have been a couple instances when I was younger where I literally gave the shirt off my back to kids who were less fortunate. And I remember one time my parents had bought me a brand new pair of Jordans, and there was a kid on my basketball team who didn't have shoes, and I gave him my shoes. I came off the bus barefoot because I didn't have shoes. And I thought my parents were going to be livid because they had just gotten me this brand new expensive pair of shoes. And I kind of walked into the house with my head down, and they looked down at my feet. They go, what happened to your shoes? I said, I gave them to someone who didn't have shoes. And they said, no, we're proud of you. In fact, we're going to go buy you two pairs of that. And I thought they would be angry, and they were actually happy. And so that just gives you an idea of who I am and what I've been about. And as I've gotten older, I've stuck to those two core principles about science and education, and then about helping others. And I decided to mold my career around, how do I optimize both of these things? How do I be involved with science and biology and disseminating information, but at the same time, making sure I'm doing everything I can to make the world a better place? I always say, God forbid, if I die tomorrow, number one, there's a two-shot minimum at my funeral. Nobody's crying. It better be a celebration. And number two, that I want people to say, Richard made a difference. And that's what drives me every single day as I wake up, saying, how can I make a difference in at least one person's life today?
Wow. So that's interesting, Dr. Harris. You know, already I can see the mold. You know, you're a giver, you're a carer. Is that something from an experience you had as a child, or you know, being part and perhaps a, you know, we've talked to other on other podcast shows of people saying, well, I was a middle child, or I had this as part of my growing up. I mean, is there anything in that with yourself?
I think it was because I was bullied a lot as a kid. And for numerous different reasons, it was the fact that I was a chubby kid. I was on prednisone for asthma as a kid. I was super chubby and I couldn't play sports because I had horrible asthma. So I got bullied all the time. And eventually I started to realize that people were going to bully you no matter what. When I got off the prednisone, I was skinny, really, really skinny. And people started bullying me for that. And I said, you know what? It doesn't matter. This isn't going to bother me. People are always going to be haters. But because I was bullied, I always felt this need to protect other people who maybe couldn't protect themselves or didn't have the right knowledge to make decisions appropriately. And I think that was what led me into this be a caregiver type of person, just because of my experiences and always wanting to help people out who had been through similar circumstances.
You know, that's a remarkable story. And, you know, there's so many, you know, so many people that have been bullied before, and it's so hard to emerge from that experience with a positive outcome. And I think you've just shared, you know, one of those rare positive outcomes that may have come from it. And, you know, I wonder, as you look at that, then, you know, and you know, talking about the way that you help people today, but what role did your parents play in this? It sounds like you also came from a background of supportive parents.
Yeah, it's interesting. My family was very dysfunctional. I come from a household with a lot of mental illness. My mom has PTSD from sexual abuse. My dad, he lost his brother and sister very young. And because of that, his parents were very, very sheltered of him. They wouldn't let him go too far from the house. He actually got into Harvard and they wouldn't let him go because it was too far away from Cleveland. And then my sister had borderline personality disorder and drug addiction. She suffered with this since she was a teenager. And so my house was very chaotic. I never knew what I was going to walk into on any given day because there was so much mental illness and so much trauma that wasn't really addressed by those in my family. And so I said, okay, I can't control this. What can I control? And I began to say, okay, I can control how much effort I put into things. I can control how much I care about certain things. So I started reaching for things that I could control. And one of those things I could control was my attitude and how I viewed things and how, if I couldn't have the life I wanted at home, I could at least try to help other people have a better life. And so that's what I focused on. Now, my parents weren't bad people. They were great people. They were loving. They just had mental health issues. And they always taught me to respect others. They always taught me the value of hard work. And so I would take those lessons and then apply them in my environment. And it was so rewarding to me. I've never been someone who cares about accolades. I've never been someone who cares about glory. I've just been someone who cares about results and improving things and improving processes. And that's really what got me to where I am today, is the fact that I put others ahead of my own interests, but not to the point that it's detrimental, because you can go too far, right? And I just try to make sure that I take care of myself, but at the same time, help other people.
So let's translate that a little bit, you know, in your journey. And that is, you know, you decide to become a pharmacist, you decide to become a doctor. What, there's a mental aspect of healthcare, but how did you decide to take that route then? Because most people would pick one or the other and then stop.
Yeah, that was complete providence again. So I got to the University of Texas, and out of high school, my two favorite courses were anatomy and physics. And I said, okay, I'm going to go into one of these two. And I liked physics more than I liked anatomy. And so I actually was a physics major. I wanted to do biomedical physics. I wanted to make prosthetics and devices and things like that. I took 1 year of physics and advanced math classes, realized I love physics. I hated math because theoretical math is so high level. And I'm looking at these problems and I'm like, when am I ever going to apply this? How is this going to help me? This is all theory. And so I needed to switch into something more practical. I switched into biochemistry, thought I wanted to do research, did bench research on fetal alcohol syndrome for 2 years, didn't like it. I was a junior, or about to be a junior. I was 20 credit hours away from graduating and had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And luckily I worked in the dean of pharmacy school's lab. He said, come to pharmacy school. I think you'd be a good fit. I had no idea what a pharmacist did, no idea what pharmacy school required. I knew nothing. I just said, okay, took the test, did well, got into pharmacy school. The first year of pharmacy school, I realized I wanted to become a physician, but I didn't want to quit because I'd never quit anything in my life. And I told myself, listen, if I quit pharmacy school, they're not going to let me in medical school because they think I'm just going to quit medical school too. And I love what I was learning. And to me, the journey is always important. I love the journey that I was on and I didn't want to leave it. A lot of my best friends are friends I made in pharmacy school. I still use a lot of the knowledge I learned in pharmacy school. And actually, pharmacy school is harder than medical school. It teaches you to be a better leader. It teaches you to more rigorously evaluate evidence than medical school. And I wouldn't be where I am today without it. But I like having a total picture. And I'm glad I did, because if I had just gone to pharmacy school, I wouldn't have learned how you diagnose things. And if I had just gone to medical school, I would have a very rudimentary knowledge of the medications and how they work and the pathways that they work on and the side effects and the nutrients that they can deplete. And so having that total picture allows me to see things differently than a lot of other providers.
That's fascinating. So you talk about earlier that you don't need accolades, yet along the journey here, you've delivered so many. You know, I mean, your resume just reads a kind of kind of technical storyboard of doctors and universities, etc. I guess so. One thing you said just now, you said I'm not a quitter. So is that something else that rings true here, that you see, potentially for others who may be listening, the biggest challenges, and you go, so what? You know, let's just go for it. So what's in you? Is it the inner now? Is it the, you know, you talked a little bit about the challenges you had growing up. Is it something there that's in you, in your DNA?
Yeah, it's partially both. There's something that we call resilience in psychology, and that's the ability to, in a good manner, deal with the struggles of life. And some people are just naturally more resilient than others, but it can be taught, and a lot of it can be your mindset. And I think a lot of this came from my grandparents. My grandfather used to tell me all the time, forge ahead. When things get tough, get tougher. And these are things that I put into myself as a child. And I remember the first real incidence of this was in seventh grade. I had just got off the prednisone. I could finally play sports because my asthma had just gone away. I'd grown out of it. And I said I wanted to make the basketball team. Didn't really play basketball, but all the kids on the street played basketball. And we had just moved to a new school. So I wanted to do something to get involved. Tried out for the basketball team, didn't make it. And instead of feeling bad about myself and feeling down and getting depressed and feeling like I wasn't good enough, I said to myself, what do I need to do to make the team? And so I started playing with kids better than me. I started playing with kids who were on the team. I started going to where they go. I started going to the camps that they went to. And I also started practicing like they practice. And I came up with a regimen, 10 minutes of shooting, 10 minutes of dribbling, 10 minutes of footwork every single day. And I did that for a year. And then the next year during practice or during tryouts, it was so incredible because I had people coming up to me during the tryout and saying, Richard, tone it down. You're making us all look bad. And I made the team. So I went from not making the team, not even being a thought, to other people telling me I'm doing too well and they're making them look bad. And that really just shaped my life because I'm not naturally talented. I'm not one of those people that things comes easy to. I've had to work really, really hard for everything I've gotten. And I would say my superpower is that I never give up. And I never beat myself up. And I always say, listen, I may not be good right now, but I can get better. And that's always how I thought. I never end my thoughts on a negative. I always say, I can improve. I can grow. I can get better. I can learn. I can try new things. And that's always been my mentality.
That's an interesting point of view. You know, in some ways, if you think about the way people kind of live their lives, Dr. Hare, some people will get to a certain point and they sort of just stop. You know, they stop learning, they stop growing, they are almost locked in time. As a doctor, do you see that sort of thing often? And what do you, how do you tell people, how do you get people to a point where they see the role that they can play to improve their quality of life?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something I see all the time. And this can happen a lot with people who have diseases that run in families. they say, oh, it's genetic and there's nothing I can do about it. Or they've been told before that this is something that they're going to deal with all of their life. And so that demotivates them because they just think, well, this is just how it is. And I tell them, listen, where your mind is at is where your body will go. If you tell yourself you can't do something, you will never do it. But if you say you can, then all of a sudden you start to think about possibilities. You start to think about empowering questions. How can I make this work? What do I need to do to get here? And when you start asking those questions, you get answers to the questions you ask. You know, Einstein said the most important thing about a question is how you ask the question. And if you ask defeating questions, like, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, why did I ever think I was good enough? You get answers to those questions. If you ask those empowering questions, you get those answers. And so what I try to do with people, the first thing I try to do is unlock their minds. Because as your mind goes, your body goes. In fact, your mind is so powerful. Optimists live 12% longer. They have a 36% reduction in cardiovascular disease. That's how powerful your mind is. One of my good friends, Dr. Chen Ron, has a cancer clinic. He's a lifestyle and functional medicine doctor. And he says the number one thing, and he has data that backs this up, about how people do is, do they develop a new mindset? It's not their age, it's not their gender, it's not their race, it's not their stage of disease, it's not their chemotherapy. It's, do they unlock their mind to believe that they can heal? And he said to me, I don't even call these miracle cases anymore because I see them all the time. That's how powerful your mindset is. And so I try to get people to think about health differently. I try to challenge their associations and their notions and have them unlock the potential that's inside of them, because your body has a wonderful ability to heal itself. We hear about these miracle stories all the time. Well, really, is there anything fundamentally different about these people? They've got the same genes we do. The difference is they believed that they could do it. They believed that they could walk again. They believed that they could beat cancer. And that is so powerful because it changes everything around your environment. Once you start to believe, you change everything, the way you do things, the way you interact with people, even the words that come out of your mouth. And words have power.
One thing linked to that then is you've got a toolbox clearly of what we'd call in the workplace, you know, leadership tools. Yeah, you know how to manage yourself in these environments. Just finally, in terms of how you got to where you got, what, you know, give us a sense of, you know, I guess for the listener, you know, any other obstacles along the way that you had, you know, is there an example you could share with us and a kind of practical session from Dr. Harris on, hey, this was something, you know, this got in the way of my master's of a business administration because of X, Y, Z.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. The most prominent thing I can think of was when I was in pharmacy school, I had suffered from insomnia for most of my life. And at one point in pharmacy school, it got so bad that I was only sleeping for 2 hours a night. And I went from a majorly A and B student to making C's. And I said, this isn't me. I was falling asleep in class all the time. I was tired. I said, what is going on? And I actually tried medication. It made me feel terrible. And this is one of the reasons why I shifted my perspective on medication and using medication appropriately, because of how that made me feel. The sleep meds made me feel awful. And then I started looking at, how do I heal myself? And I started Googling and researching and talking to my professors. And I stumbled upon sleep hygiene. And I realized that I had a bunch of really terrible behaviors and habits that were keeping me from sleeping correctly. And then I really began to work on that. And then I started sleeping from 2 hours a night to 6 hours a night. My grades came back up. But it got to the point where one of the professors almost wanted to kick me out of school because he didn't like me because I kept falling asleep in his class. And I had to have other professors stand up for me and say, this isn't his normal behavior. This isn't who he is. Something must be off. And I had to fight through that. And I actually ended up graduating with honors.
Wow.
And that's something that I'm very proud of. But we all have these obstacles in our path. And instead of saying can't, like I said before, I said, what can I do? I know this can improve. There must be something that I can improve. And then that's when I started incrementally improving things. Things got better and it got me right back on track.
So kind of in that context, Dr. Harris, what do you see are kind of the main obstacles or challenges to healthy living for most people?
Yeah, that is very difficult. The default in America is disease. 60% of adults have one chronic disease, 40% have two. There is literally more sick people in America than there are healthy people. The default is disease. And I think the major problem with that is people are unaware of what they're doing on a daily basis that's either adding to their health or subtracting from their health. I've had people come in with stomach issues all the time. And I say, what are you eating? Well, I'm eating fast food every single day, multiple times a day. And they never correlated that that could be the problem. And that's why they're having stomach issues. Well, do you eat any vegetables? No, I don't eat any vegetables. There are people, and I see this all the time, who literally don't know that eating vegetables is important for their health. And it is a key factor in why they're having some of the disease and dysfunction that they're having. I think that's the major issue, is that we don't do enough to inform health consumers about what is causing dysfunction in their health and then what they can do about it as far as how they're interacting with their environment. One of the most powerful determinants of your health that correlates stronger than most other things is what zip code you live in, because that determines so much of your environment. And people don't understand this. And we do a poor job of teaching people this about environmental health, about population health. And that's one of the reasons why I started my podcast. That's one of the reasons I'm big on content and big on education, because how can you make a decision without information? It would be like, okay, I'm going to go buy a car, and you've got a family of seven and you buy a smart car, right? That doesn't match your lifestyle. That doesn't match your needs. That doesn't match the information that you should have had. And so I think that's the biggest problem. And the second biggest problem is that there is a lot of marketing that is done to people, and it's counterintuitive to what's actually healthy for them. And you see a lot of these marketing terms, organic and grass-fed, grass-finished, natural flavors. People have no idea what they mean. And there's no real standard on what that actually means. Is it grass-fed? Does it eat 100% of the time grass? Does it eat 20% of the time? We don't know, right? And so there's a lot of misinformation around what's actually healthy and what people should do. And I think that that is a big cause of why we have so much disease and disability.
That's a really, you know, it's a deep topic. Yeah, and I get the points you raise. What about the other side that links into that? What about externally, you know, businesses that I work with as a consultant, you know, food businesses and beverage businesses, and I guess say governments too, what job and roles do they have here?
I think that they have a big role. And if you look at a lot of other countries, a lot of these products are very clearly labeled. Like I was in Mexico about a month ago, and you look at a lot of their products and this says, this has excessive calories. This has excessive saturated fat. This has a lot of carbohydrates. So people are actually labeled with things that they could actually know and make informed decisions. Most people here don't even know how to read a food label. They don't even know what they're getting in. And I think that it's partially on the person, but it's partially on us because it's been intentionally done that way to confuse people. Also, if you look at other countries, and I actually had the pleasure of talking to Jerome Adams, our former Surgeon General, and I asked him this question. I said, look, if you look at Europe and a lot of the other countries, they ban a lot of these ingredients that are in our foods and in our products that have been linked to all kinds of adverse outcomes. And I asked him, is this something that's on Washington's radar? And he told me, he said that here in America, we prioritize the ability of a company to make a profit over someone's health. And it's on the consumer to educate themselves about their health. But the average consumer thinks that, oh, the government's got my back. This product wouldn't be on the shelves if it wasn't safe. But look at the sunscreen recall. And we're only at the tip of the iceberg on that. There's a study done 2 years ago that showed that the ingredients in sunscreen get more in our bloodstream than we thought, way past the amount that is legal. And no one knows what effect these have on the body because they weren't ever really studied. So there's a lot in the area of consumer protection that we're lacking on. And again, I'm a business owner. I believe in the ability to make a profit, but it shouldn't be at the expense of someone's health, and it shouldn't be without informed consent.
So tell us a little bit about that. You have the Strive for Great Health podcast. What's your purpose and how are you handling that?
Yeah, I started the podcast because it wasn't an altruistic mission. I kept getting asked the same questions over and over again. And I said, okay, I need a way to put all this content on the internet and let people come to it. And I said, I'm either going to start a podcast or a blog. I do writing. In my consulting company, I write articles and things like that for clients. I just don't like doing it. I love speaking. And so that's why I started the podcast. And the main goal was to give people information about health that's backed by research. I have a folder with, I think it's close to 700 clinical trials. I typically read 2 to 3 clinical trials a week. Most of my colleagues, unfortunately, haven't read a single clinical trial since they finished residency. And so I'm always getting up on the data. And if people question me, I say, listen, this is my interpretation of the data. You're free to read this study yourself. Here's the study. And I wanted an evidence-based, science-based podcast that informs people about this is what science says about what is your health is at risk for and what you can do to optimize and improve your health. And a lot of my inspiration came from blue zones. Blue zones are areas where there is virtually no chronic disease. People literally die of old age, but they don't die infirmed. They don't die with dementia. They die actually healthy and vibrant. And if you look at their lifestyles, there's a big difference between their lifestyles and our lifestyles, what they eat, how they interact, their social structures. And I think that's so powerful. And that's why I want people to know that, look, there's a lot of great data behind meditation. There's a lot of great data behind fasting. There's a lot of great data behind exercise. There's a lot of data behind these lifestyle interventions that can actually help and improve your life, quality of life, and your longevity. Because to me, that's the goal. I want a long health span. I want a long time where I don't have a disease. And you can increase your health span and your lifespan through these behaviors. And that's the whole goal of the podcast.
It's a fascinating thing because you talked about the blue zones. And if my memory is correct, they also have the longest lifespans. And you know, you made that distinction between lifespan and health span. And, you know, it seems like in the US at least, we tend to kind of institutionalize, right? So people can have a long lifespan. Oftentimes they're institutionalized sort of towards the end into, you know, care facilities, which again, I'm not criticizing, but you know, what I think you're talking about is making good choices earlier in life so that your ability, your quality of life is high for as long as possible.
Absolutely. And this is the thing. This is a great point. This is the thing about disease. Most people think that disease is instantaneous. Like when you have a heart attack, you just had a heart attack. Well, on average, it takes 15 years for a heart attack to develop. It takes somewhere between 20 to 30 years for dementia to develop. So I always tell people what you do in your 20s determines how your life is going to be in your 40s. What you do in your 40s determines your life in your 60s. What you do in your 60s determines your life in your 80s. Because that's how long the lag is in a lot of these things. And it's really sad because there are cases of people developing type 2 diabetes at 4 or 5 years old.
Wow.
And that person will never have a normal life because what kid is going to eat properly? It's very, very hard, right? And so this person is going to develop end-stage diseases, kidney disease, strokes, heart attacks in their 20s and 30s. In fact, I see it all the time. 10 years ago, never saw anybody in their 30s with a heart attack, stroke, on dialysis. I see it all the time now. people younger than me coming in with heart attacks, people younger than me coming in with strokes, people younger than me on kidney disease, on dialysis because of kidney disease. And that is heartbreaking because I know that process probably started when they were a teenager. And that's on us as a society to make this better. Because if they're growing up in a place, in an environment where they're not getting the right information, their parents don't have the right information, that kid never had a chance at a normal, healthy life. And that's a failure as a society. If our children, our kids are not having a chance at a normal, healthy life.
Do you, in terms of the aspect, and you mentioned blue zones, is that something, and pardon my lack of learning, is that something that I should know? Is that something in the US? Is that a term?
Yeah, there's been a book, I forget who wrote about it, and it's something you'll hear a lot of us naturopathic doctors talk about, right, is these blue zones. There's actually one in California. It's an Amish-like community. And that's the one that's been studied here in the US, and there are pockets all over the world, but they follow more of a traditional type of lifestyle.
Okay, got it.
So I gotta ask you this, and maybe it sounds a little bit crass, but Dr. Harris, are we uninformed or are we lazy when it comes to healthcare?
Both, and that's the worst combination. Most people will not invest in themselves, which is crazy. They'll go spend hundreds of dollars on new purses and new shoes and new clothes, but eating healthy is too expensive. That new $1,000 iPhone, gotta have it. And you look at this and you say, wait a minute, this isn't right. We used to spend, I believe, and I'm not gonna get these numbers correct because it's a while since I looked at this data. I believe we used to spend 30% of our income on food back in like the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. Now we spend about 10%. Mm-hmm. And that makes a big difference in our health. And so because we're a very instant gratification type of society now, the benefits of being healthy, I'm not going to see for 10 or 15 years, a lot of it, right? And so to those people, they're like, well, I feel fine now, so why am I worried about the future? But again, this disease processes are smoldering. Your body does a really good job of compensating until it can't anymore. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we are so focused on the now and not the future. And you see that in a lot of aspects. Most millennials don't have any savings. You know, that's a big problem that people are trying to figure out right now, because we're so immediate focused that we don't think about the long term and think about the implications. Even though there's a recent study that came out that had four simple interventions on nutrition, exercise, meditation, and sleep. It was an 8-week study, and they looked at biological age, which is a test that looks at how old you are at the cellular level. And for most people, if you're healthy, your biological age can be younger than your chronological age. If you're diseased, your biological age is older than your chronological age. And you can tell in some people who are 30, they look like they're 50. And then other people are 50, they look like they're 20.
Yeah.
And that's a good indication of your biological age a lot of times. But this study in 8 weeks had people reverse, I think it was 3.27 years on their biological age in 8 weeks. So these interventions, you can see, if you look in the right places at the cellular level, you can see changes start to happen very quickly.
I'm fascinated by your position there on, the current day society, the disposable income piece, the self gratification, which I guess, Bob, as a marketer outside in, that's a longer discussion, because I guess, has that changed recently, or were we always a self gratification, and the environment in which we live has changed, iPhones and the televisions and all the rest of it. But I want to lean on that piece that you just said about the disposable income, because another facet outside of that, you could argue, is that some of the poorer foods are the lowest price. So that entry point of buying a good, healthy diet that we would say is a healthy product can be at a premium. But I guess I'm at a dichotomy here, because you're saying, and it might be you know, kind of universal piece here, but a lot of people could make that choice. They could buy a healthier, you know, in the UK, we could have a bread that's from a factory that's churned out with, you know, all sorts of additives to keep it fresh. You know, literally there are ingredients in it to keep it fresher longer, so that the cost of the product, you know, comes down and it's not as goodness. Whereas you can get a fresh baked product that will cost you a lot more. So I'm kind of, you know, considering what you're saying here. Yeah, are you saying that's facts? So in America, for example, if the habits changed, if people said I'm going to spend less on iPhones and all the rest of it, that there would still be a supply and demand balance. In other words, the pricing of the product would be achievable for whole of society in terms of a good product, a healthier product.
Yeah, this is something that some people have looked at. Now, there are multiple studies looking at, well, how much does it actually cost to extra to eat healthy? And this is just direct cost. We're not talking opportunity cost, and we're not talking the long-term, the cost savings of being healthy. In the direct cost, it costs about $1 to $2 more per day to eat healthy. And that's a lot of fresh food, vegetables, fruits, and high quality meats. Now, if you look at the cost savings, there was a study that came out that showed that if you start exercising early, right, in your 20s, and you're looking at costs in your 60s, you can save almost $2,000 a year on healthcare costs.
Wow.
And so if you look at it in totality, if you invest more in your health, you actually reap more savings on the back end, because healthcare is very expensive. The per capita amount for healthcare in this country is around $11,000. That's how much we spend per person on healthcare. Right. Yet we have some of the lowest outcomes in comparable economic OECD countries. You know, like compared to the UK, we have double the rates of diabetes, double the rates of obesity, double the rates of heart disease. And I think that's a lot of what we talk about. We don't invest in our health. And the other problem is our subsidies are all in the wrong place. We subsidize corn, we subsidize soy, we subsidize wheat. And let's say a corn farmer wants to grow blueberries on his farm. He can't. He'll lose his subsidies. And then 90% of the corn that's made in this country actually goes to ethanol and high fructose corn syrup. It doesn't even go to actual corn on people's plates. So if we had subsidies and actually subsidizing food that was healthy for us, that would go a long way towards decreasing the cost. And there's a reason, and it shouldn't be this way, that this processed food costs less than actual whole foods. And part of that is because of the subsidies. Part of that is because economies of scale, the demand is lower for these things. And so it costs more to produce. And in America, the consumer dollar speaks, and we're starting to see more and more people start to wake up to this and demand safer products, demand healthier alternatives. And as that increases, you'll start to see, or hopefully see, more shifts in the processes that allow the prices for these things to become cheaper. And then if you look at some of the studies where programs where they gave prescription food, food pharmacies, overall costs decreased dramatically, because people were spending less in ER visits and hospital visits. So there's data that backs this up. It's just, we need to start moving in that direction, but it's going to be slow.
So who does what? You know, you talked about education. How does that work? How do you get the call to action?
Yeah, it starts with individuals, and then it starts with building systems. And so nowadays, which is great thing about social media, if you have a message, you can get it out there. And we're seeing a lot more people come around to some holistic providers on Instagram and TikTok and things like that and start listening. And a lot of these providers have courses, or they have podcasts where they talk about these things. You know, I tend to think like a marketer, right? I think the fundamental failure of our clinical institutions is they're okay with an average 7-minute visit with a person. That's one touch point for 7 minutes. What can you do with one touch point in 7 minutes? Not a whole lot. You're not going to get a whole lot of buy-in. For us, conversion is someone changing their behaviors.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. So I try to create multiple touch points. And what do we say in marketing? Take 7 touch points to make a sale. I want to create multiple touch points with an individual so that I can start to reorient their buying decision and start to have them invest in their health. And so I look at healthcare like a business. And that's my MBA training. And that's my, you know, running my own business training. But if you apply that to healthcare, you can start to see some improvements. So we need more content. We need a way to get information in people's hands outside of a doctor's office because we don't have that much time. The system doesn't allow it. Our primary care providers are seeing 20 to 30 patients a day, every 15 minutes. And so you need to give people resources to meet them where they are at home. And then you need to tailor it to where they are on the transtheoretical model of change. And I'll do that with people in my office. And my podcast will talk to the different aspects because, you know, my audience is all over the place. So I'm talking to people no matter where they are in that change diagram. And if more medical institutions thought like this, thought about what happens with that person at home and outside of the office, I think we'd see better outcomes.
Fascinating point, Dr. Harris, because on the one hand, I feel like probably a fair number of people have no interaction with their healthcare provider unless they're either sick or hurt. They got a problem, so that's their touch point, and that ends up being sort of the topic. So the world is in the midst of, you know, a health situation unlike anything that anyone alive has seen before in COVID. And obviously there are massive tragic, you know, outcomes of that. But are there any positives that come of that? This wellspring of concern about health, is it possible that some of this might result in people kind of rethinking like, hey, maybe this is something I need to think about more often?
I hope so, but the data is not trending towards that. There was a study that came out a couple months ago that showed last year, the average American gained 1.5 pounds a month. Wow. That is usually what people gain in a year. And that was happening every single month. So think about a year's worth of wear and tear on the body happening in a month. The implications of that over the next couple of years are going to be staggering. I think you're going to see a massive acceleration in diabetes, massive acceleration in heart disease, massive acceleration in kidney disease and cancer, all of these things linked to obesity. I think that health is at the forefront, but the message is wrong. And this is one of the things that really made me angry about a lot of these TV doctors and stuff like that, was it was vaccine this, isolation that. Not one time did I hear a TV doctor talk about, hey, eat your vegetables. Not one time did I hear him talk about exercise. There's been multiple studies that have come out during the pandemic showing how exercise boosts the immune system and helps prevent severe COVID complications. You barely even heard them talk about vitamin D, even though multiple studies have linked low vitamin D levels to worse outcomes. You don't hear them talk about meditation and stress management. You never hear them talk about the host. The most important part about fighting off a virus is the health of the host, by far. And if we had prioritized health of the host instead of scaring people into a stressful state where they're stress eating and they're gaining weight and they're afraid and they're socially isolated. So we had the complete wrong message from the beginning. And I think people are more cognizant of their health. But again, if the message isn't right, it's not going to do us any good. And I'm actually worried about long-term mental health implications. Last June and July, there was a study that showed that anxiety screenings went up 407% and depression screenings went up 457%.
Wow.
The only thing we can really compare this to is natural disasters. And if you look at data coming out of Katrina, rates of depression were higher for years afterwards. And that's a one-time event. This is something that's spanned for years now and something we're still dealing with. And we have no idea when the end is in sight. And again, the health of our mind is intricately linked to the health of our bodies, and the health of our bodies are linked to the health of our minds. And I think that the message needs to change. And a lot of us holistic docs have been pushing this message about hope, about what you can do to keep yourself healthy, about lifestyle medicine and how powerful it is for our health. And I think that that's what should be coming out while people are more focused on their health. And one of the things that really made me angry was when I was taking care of COVID patients in the hospital and I walk into their room and there'd be a bag of chips and a Coke. And I would just almost lose it that this is what we're feeding people when they're sick, and that these people have no idea what that's doing to their immune system and their bodies while they're trying to fight off infection. And that right there, also combined with the fact that if you go to the cancer ward, there's a vending machine on the cancer ward serving up all this junk.
Yeah.
That right there encapsulates everything that is wrong with our healthcare, or what we like to call our sick care system.
Dr. Harris, you know, you are a glass half full person too, you know, and you readily shared some stories earlier, you know, and I put my hand up here, you know, throughout the year here in the UK, I definitely had escapism. You know, I definitely had times where the food bill and the characteristics of that food bill changed, yeah, to just enjoyment, because you know, didn't want to necessarily, or couldn't necessarily get out and stuff. But putting that aside, you also mentioned the percentage game, that if people looked after themselves, you know, their cell structure, then the generation would be healthier. You know, the people listening to this podcast, I guess we don't want to scare people, but is there a way out here, you know, for them? You know, can they say, right, okay, right now, let's get back to the gym, you know, and I'm sure in the US it's happening here. I just signed up my gym membership again. You know, is there things that we, you know, listeners should be saying, right, okay, it was a terrible year, let's get back out there.
Yeah, I like to give people some simple tips. There are four things that are very important to our overall health. Number one, nutrition. And the most important aspect of nutrition is just eat real food. And when people ask me, what do you mean by that? I tell them, if it wasn't around when your grandma was alive, you probably shouldn't be eating it. What did grandma used to eat? Vegetables, meats, fruits. What did grandma cook with? Olive oil, butter, lard, tallow. That's what I tell people. We have to go a little bit more ancestral and eat of the fruits of the land. Then there's exercise. Most people think you have to go to the gym for an hour a day. You don't have to go to the gym for that long. There's data that shows you can do a 7-minute home bodyweight exercise a few times a week and get all the metabolic benefits of exercise. So I tell people, get 2 days of strength training a week. And even if you can only get in 10 minutes, that's better than no minutes. 15 is better than 10. If you get up to 30, 35 minutes, that's great. You don't really need to do much longer than that. And then get moving throughout the day. I'm actually standing right now. I got a standing desk and I make sure I stand. We have a dog. I get 8,000 steps a day. If you get 8,000 steps a day, it'll decrease your risk of death from all medical causes by 50%. That's astronomical reduction.
Wow.
Then there's stress management. If you look at stress, your cumulative lifetime stress predicts getting a chronic medical disease better than your age, because that's how detrimental stress is for our bodies. If you look at all societies throughout time until modern time, they all meditated. We stopped doing that recently. They meditated before they knew it was beneficial. You want to decrease your blood pressure. You want to improve your cognition. You want to improve your memory, decrease your stress, improve your sense of well-being, be more present in the moment, decrease anxiety, meditate. It actually changes the structure and function of our brains. It actually releases something called BDNF, which is brain growth food. It makes our nerves grow strong and healthy, and those connections strong and healthy, and your brain function like it should. So 20 minutes, 3 times a day or 3 times a week. You can use Headspace, Calm, Insight Timer. These are apps. The fourth thing is get enough sleep. We need 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Sleep is not a luxury. It's a necessity. The number one thing I see with brain fog, which a lot of people complain about, is number one, they're not eating the right things. Number two, they're stressed. Number three, they're not getting enough sleep. You correct that, it'll actually improve. In fact, sleep is the best way to protect our brains as we get older. There's data that correlates with lack of sleep and developing dementia, because sleep is when our brains clean itself. Sleep is when our brains wash toxins out of itself. Sleep is when our nerves repair and make new connections and encode memories. If your memory is bad and you're not getting enough sleep, your memory's bad because you're not getting enough sleep. It's a literal function of sleep to encode memories. So I focus on those four things with people. And I say, listen, don't try to do everything at once. Pick one thing. Pick the one thing you think you can start with. If it's meditation, if it's your nutrition, if it's improving your sleep, if it's exercise, pick one. Really master that and get that in your schedule to where you're not even thinking about it. It's second nature. Then move on to the next one. And so you layer small change after small change after small change. And then you end up with a bulletproof lifestyle where you're fighting disease and ensuring your own health.
Wow. You know, and it all sounds so workable. You know, I mean, those four things that you just talked about, I could see that our listeners would say, well, I can do that. You know, it doesn't require this Herculean effort that, you know, would be really hard to stick with. So really, really appreciate that. Well, Dr. Richard Harris hosts the Strive for Great Health podcast. We encourage everyone to have a listen to that. And you'll hear more of these, you know, nuggets of wisdom about health, but also about things that you can actually do. And that's why we're so grateful, Dr. Harris, that you joined us. I mean, this is exactly the kind of actionable advice that anybody, our listeners or anyone, can actually include in their daily lifestyle and improve their health outcomes. So really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me today. You asked some tough questions. I like that. It made me think, and I hope I gave some good answers for people. And just realize to the listeners, you have the power. The only difference between the people who can and the people who can't is the people who can say they can, and they do. That's zero. There's zero difference. Nothing makes us special. There's no special juice. There's no inherent thing that we're born with. It's just a decision. You make a decision to do, or you make a decision to don't, and then you follow through.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.